Hello and welcome to The Scoop, a provincial newscast and podcast with stories from LJI journalists around British Columbia. Each week, reporters from Revelstoke, Cortez Island, Kootenay, Terrace, Prince George, and Smithers will share the news affecting their place in BC. I'm your host and producer, Pamela Hassan, from CSCK News in Smithers. The Scoop was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program, or LJI. Follow The Scoop on CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 FM, every Thursday and Saturday at noon, online at smithersradio.com, and of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on The Scoop, BC First Nations hosts a climate leadership session in Terrace. The BC Assembly of First Nations is holding its BC First Nations Climate Leadership Engagement Session in Terrace this week. Terry TG, Regional Chief of the BCAFN, spoke with CFNR about how these are pivotal gatherings aimed at addressing climate change and related emergencies in Indigenous communities. Sabrina Spencer at CFNR in Terrace will bring you more. No word just yet on whether the province will help Revelstoke wastewater treatment upgrades project this year. The city of Revelstoke still has no answer on whether the province will provide assistance with a significant cost increase to upgrades to its city water management system after Mayor Gary Siltz and Director of Infrastructure and Planning Steve Black traveled to Victoria to meet with Deputy Minister of Environment Kevin Jardine. Stoke FM's Melissa Jameson will bring you more on that story. And a food truck to feed the hungry ferry travelers. After years of going hungry while waiting for ferry overloads at the Whaletown BC Ferry Terminal, travelers will finally have access to a snack as Sunflower Foods opens their truck on Bayer Point Road. Lonnie Taylor at CKTZ on Cortez Island has more on that story coming up. And in Smithers at CICK News, I dig into the vandalism along the Skeena Corridor as tensions heat up over territorial disputes. Stay with us.
You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan.
Last week, we reported about the RCMP investigation into vandalism to several signs that were erected along the Highway 16 corridor by the nine allied tribes of Lac aux Lambs, outlining their traditional place names and territorial boundaries. It was also previously reported that the Cassock's Wilderness Resort sign was set ablaze in early April, which is owned by Kitsum Kalem. In the past, territorial conflict due to overlapping claims along the Lower Skeena have a long-standing history in Northwest BC. Today, I speak with Stan Dennis, spokesperson for the nine allied tribes.
Hello, my name is Stan Dennis, Jr. I'm the Gullamalia for the Lac aux Lambs Allied Tsimshian Tribes. Gullamalia means spokesperson in our language, currently residing in Lac aux Lambs.
Great, Stan. Thanks so much for being with us here on CICK News. Of course, I wanted to chat with you today just about the situation that's unfolded along the Skeena Corridor between Rupert and Terrace with the Skeena signage project that Lac aux Lambs has undertaken. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about the project first.
The project itself there, we wanted to document some of our, a little bit of our history, our oral history and whatnot, and our tribal affiliations to the land and all that in our maps, and present that as a little bit of a reminder of guests coming into the territory, and letting them know who owns the territory and whatnot. We have nine tribes in our community here, and we present all those tribal maps. Well, approximately 40 years now they were established, and over 40 years. So, yeah, it was just something that we wanted to kind of produce something in a new fashion, so that bring awareness to guests visiting this territories that this is who owns it, and this is unceded territory of the allied tribes.
Yeah, Stan, I saw some of the signage being put up, and was able to stop and take a look, and it gives a map. It shows a map of the Skeena corridor there, and then also the place names, traditional place names. Tell me a little bit about, you know, what are some of those places in particular that are really important to the Nine Allied Tribes? One that I've visited a couple of years ago was Port Essington, and it seems like that was on the map as well. So what are some of the oral histories that you hope that people would take away from if they were to stop and take a look at those signs?
Yeah, we just wanted to, I say again, make sure that, you know, we're bringing awareness to the territories and be respectful, just basically asking them to be respectful and enjoy yourselves while you're in our territories. And a lot of importance, like when you talk about Port Essington there, that belongs to our Gitxaslas tribe. So that reserve there was turned over by one of the place names that my father now wears. But back in the day, it allowed him, because there are so much resources in there, that wanted to share the resources with everybody else that wanted to have access to it. So because it was back in the day, there was a heavy abundance. So that's just one of the little short stories that I have in regards to the Port Essington area. Spooksuit, we call that in our language, and belongs to the Gitxaslas tribe.
Now, Stan, I know that, you know, a lot of the time over the years, there's been some contention over overlapping territories, and it seems like after these signs were put up very quickly, they were vandalized and cut down. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about what happened and when you heard about that, because it seems like it happened pretty quickly after they were put up along the Skeena corridor.
I believe it was around April 8th of this year we started erecting the signs in our territory, and we had representatives of staff from our business development and Lac-O-Lam's band, staff members and fisheries and all that, giving a hand, working together, putting them up. And then, it just so happened that within a few hours after having them put up there, they were vandalized, and our members weren't too happy about it, but because we don't condone any kind of act of vandalism on anybody else's property, and this was ours. So, and we're not one to point fingers as to speculate who did it, but we didn't. We just wanted to make sure that we will continue to do that, and just to bring awareness. So we had to re-erect the signs again after that original April, I believe it was April 8th of this year. The first one went up, and not too long after that, we re-erect them, and a month later, around early May.
Yeah, and I was also able to check in with the RCMP. It sounds like there's an investigation going on to, find out and ascertain who might have vandalized the signs. Is there anything that you've heard from the RCMP as to how the investigation is going?
No, we haven't heard anything in regards to investigation. Just that we were going through the Prince Rupert detachment we have a file going through them and asking anybody that has seen or witnessed anything happening to the signs that they bring that information forward to the RCMP at Prince Rupert. That's about as far as my involvement has been with that. But there is an open file.
You've been listening to CICK News.
This is a CKTZ News update. I'm Lonnie Taylor. Local food company Sunflower Foods is opening a new establishment near the ferry terminal in Whaletown. It's been many years since any food service addressed the need at the ferry terminal to feed tourists and locals when they inevitably wait sometimes 2 to 6 hours for ferry overloads in the summertime. I caught up with the owner of the Sunflower Foods business, Carrie Taylor, to find out how they made this happen and what their plan is for the summer and beyond to feed hungry locals and tourists waiting for the ferry. Your newest business venture is you're going to be delivering food to all the hungry people waiting at the ferry terminal.
Not delivering. We're not going to leave the food truck. They're going to hopefully come to us. And yes, and it's snacks. We're calling it a snack truck because I don't want people to expect there to be what we used to have at the food truck. We don't have a kitchen. It's all ready to go, which is really good for people who are time sensitive, especially with the ferry. So it's like they can just grab and run back to their car.
So where exactly is it located?
So it's right on the corner of Byers Point Road and Harbor Road. So right above the parking lot, basically. So you would turn onto Byers Point Road and you'd see it right there. You can see it from the road really easily. And now we've got signs everywhere. So it would be really clear. We've got a big sign that says open. So when we're open, that sign will be up. And when we're closed, that sign will be not visible.
So you opened today, is that right?
Yes, we opened at 7 this morning. So one of the only concerns that we have about having the food truck where we do is it's on a private street that's not a through street. And we're just a little nervous about the people that live on that street and all the extra traffic that's going to be going through. And we just want to make sure that everyone stays off the road and the parking is done to the side and that people are really safe and aware on that road. And we don't disturb the neighbors over there.
Just to clarify, it sounded from the description that the truck would be walkable from, if people were parked in the ferry lineup, they would be able to walk to the food truck. Is that true?
Absolutely. We walk down to put a sign down by where the bathroom is. And it's a decent walk down all the way. It's not too far. It's the first property, but you could easily park in the parking lot and then just walk up from there. And that would be really quick too. So if you're a local with a car coming down, you could park in the parking lot and walk up. And we figure for most people, it's an easy walk down from the front of the line up to Byers Point Road.
You're saying it's the property that used to have the cafe running out of it. So that's right at the corner. It's part of that property boundaries Harbor Road where the ferry lineup is, right?
Exactly. But the entrance to where the cafe was is on Harbor Road. And we're actually not using that entrance. So you do have to go around to Byers Point. So it's a bit of a hike around the corner, but it's not that far.
Okay. So May 26th, opening day, 7 a.m. start. And what is the schedule intended for the summer season?
At this point, it's really hard to say, which I don't like not having. I like consistency. I want to tell people when we're going to be there and when we're not going to be there. So our thought is to be open Sundays and Mondays for the rest of May and June, opening at 7. We're not sure what time we're going to close. I would guess it's going to be around 12, so just after the 11:50 ferry or 2. Again, we don't know what the ferry traffic is like, so we're just assuming that we're going to be open from 7 until noon at the minimum, Sundays and Mondays. And then we'd like to add Thursdays for the priority ferry. So open at 7 again for all of the locals and then closing when the lineup just dwindles out. So again, we're assuming it's just going to be maybe the first two or three ferries. And then if all goes well and things look good as the summer picks up, we'll open on Tuesdays. And that will probably be it because of staffing issues. As everyone knows on Cortez, that's going to be tough. And I can't physically work the truck myself. So we're just going to go with the minimum for the summer.
I don't actually know how long it's been. There used to be a house there that was a cafe, but that was before my time. So I think it's been quite some time. Have you heard, as anyone said, this hasn't happened since Blaine?
And there have been people since then that have done small things like bringing down pies or small things like the little coffee cart when the ferry lineups are really long and nothing is consistent. People are trying to get something going. So yeah, it's been a while since there's been something consistent down there. So we're hoping that this is something consistent and long-term and we can just keep building it up with a nicer place to sit and more of a view and bigger menu. Yeah, it's been a while, so I'm really excited. We've been trying to get this going for a few years. This has been my dream for a few years to get down to the ferry. And so it's been a long time coming. I'm really excited.
Lonnie Taylor, CKTZ News, Cortez Island.
Of Revelstoke still has no answers on whether the province will provide assistance with a significant cost increase to upgrade the city's wastewater management system after an in-person meeting with Deputy Minister of Environment Kevin Jardine. Revelstoke Mayor Gary Sauls and Director of Infrastructure and Planning Steve Black traveled to Victoria to meet with Jardine in hopes of resolving issues the city is facing in getting a much-needed wastewater treatment system upgrade and expansion underway. They provided a brief update at the regular council meeting on May 28th. Of concern is a demand from the BC Ministry of Environment for the city to meet immediate compliance with municipal wastewater regulations and an apparent loss of interest by the province to allow the city to use a phased approach to meet the regulations. The ministry had originally given the thumbs up for a phased approach. However, after funding for the project was secured, the ministry withdrew its approval. This has ballooned the cost of the project from $14 million to $35 million. At its regular meeting on March 12th, Council gave approval for a delegation to travel to Victoria to ask the province for additional funding or to respect the original intent of the liquid waste management plan. In a follow-up letter to Minister Jardine, dated May 13th, Saul said the meeting was, quote, an important step forward in solving the issues facing the city's proposed plan to upgrade and expand the existing wastewater treatment, end quote. In addition to meeting with Minister Jardine, the city sent a letter to Minister of Municipal Affairs Anne Kang. That letter, dated April 17th, notes that Revelstoke's current wastewater treatment plant is operating under a permit issued in 1973. It states that, quote, growth over the last 60 years has increased the amount of treated wastewater to near the maximum allowable under the existing permit, end quote. The letter further notes that, quote, as a resort municipality, we anticipate continued growth and increased provincial contributions. However, without further investment in an upgraded wastewater treatment plan, we may be forced to limit this growth, end quote. Speaking to council during the May 28th meeting, Mayor Sauls said there has been no definitive timeline given and no word on whether the province will do anything to help alleviate the $20 million cost increase on the project. He said the city is continuing to reach out to the province for help and solutions to see the much-needed wastewater treatment upgrades move ahead. For 92.5 Stoke FM in Revelstoke, I'm Melissa Jamieson.
And Dawaluan, I'm Sabrina Spencer with The Journey Continues, highlighting local stories that matter to you. The BC Assembly of First Nations is hosting a climate leadership engagement session in Terrace on June 5th. CFNR spoke with Terry Tiji, Regional Chief for British Columbia Assembly of First Nations, about the upcoming event. He says they aim to address climate change and other emergencies within First Nations community, and he stresses the importance of engaging leadership, environmental administrators, and those with emergency experience to gather information, share resources, and identify implementation strategies. The sessions are open to all 204 First Nation communities, which seek to overcome bureaucratic hurdles and maximize resource utilization. Tiji encourages attendance at upcoming sessions in Terrace, Chilliwack, Campbell River, and Haida Gwaii to foster collaboration and develop effective responses to climate-related challenges.
Terry Tiji, Regional Chief for the British Columbia Assembly of First Nations.
Coming up, they're going to be hosting the First Nation Climate Leadership Engagement Sessions.
Yes, that's correct.
What's the reason for holding these different sessions in the various different communities?
Well, I think, you know, this is really part of the BC First Nations climate strategy in terms of engaging with First Nations. And I think, moreover, it is looking at to really, I think, more towards implementation. We understand what the issues are. We understand what is going on within our First Nations communities in terms of climate change. And beyond that, we need to really start beginning to think about how best that can occur. How best can that really, I suppose, engage in terms of rubber hitting the road and part of the whole perspective from First Nations, especially the last few years in terms of climate change, the many fires, emergencies that we've been seeing. It's really important to get a better understanding of how best to engage or implement the strategy itself.
So for these gatherings, who are you hoping that will try and attend these events?
Well, I think for in terms of engagement, who should attend is First Nations leadership, especially chiefs and councils. And further to that is, I would say, First Nations environmental administrators and those that are really part of dealing with the issues of the environment. And also those that have experience and or have knowledge of emergencies are really important to attend these sessions, which are will give the, I suppose, a better understanding of how best to move forward.
So this event here is going to be open not just for these communities that are listed, but pretty much anybody who's willing to attend?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, you register. We do have posters, social media on our website. I think it's more catered towards First Nations communities and nations. Really, I think it's open to all 204 First Nations communities that are dealing with climate issues, but also other emergencies, you know, such as floods, other emergencies that are out there that are communities that are trying to deal with. I mean, if we look at the current opioid crisis, we look at the crisis of homelessness, we look at the crisis of, we just came out of a pandemic. I think it's really necessary to better understand how best to utilize a lot of the resources we do have, but also increase the resources that we need, especially in terms of emergencies in regards to climate change.
So it's more than just information gathering from First Nations, but you're also providing information for them as well?
Well, certainly providing information and providing also getting direction how best to move forward. I think it's really important to better understand what are the best practices out there. But more importantly, I think what is necessary is that we get a good understanding how best to move forward. Because right now, you know, we've definitely had a number of sessions over the last several years. We know what the issues are. So how best can we implement some of these strategies? And certainly part of that is cutting down a lot of the red tape and bureaucratic impediments to how First Nations can better service their communities in terms of emergencies.
Is there anything else you'd like to share or add at all?
Yeah, this is one of 8 sessions. Terrace on June 5th are sessions that are coming up that potentially that many can attend to. And at the end of June 27th in Chilliwack in Stolo Territory, and then Campbell River on Vancouver Island on July 3rd. So in terms of sessions that are coming up, Haida Gwaii June 3rd and Terrace June 5th is, you know, sessions that are happening in the Northwest Coast.
This story is brought to you in partnership with the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You can see the full story at frequencynews.ca.
And that's this week's episode of The Scoop, a podcast and broadcast featuring stories from remote BC by the journalists in the communities of Smithers, Cortez Island, Revelstoke, Kootenay, Prince George, and Terrace. This program was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Tune in next week for another episode and follow us online wherever you get your podcasts.